The chair reclined. The drip started. Clear liquid moved through the line and into a body that did not need it. The patient trusted the man in the white coat. He said the scans were bad. He said the cancer was aggressive. He said waiting would be deadly. Inside a Detroit cancer clinic, chemotherapy flowed day after day. Some patients were weak, nauseous, terrified. Others felt confused. Their tests never seemed to match how sick they were supposed to be. Questions stayed quiet. This was a doctor. This was treatment. This was survival. Behind the closed doors, charts told a different story. Diagnoses were stretched. Lab results were altered or ignored. Expensive drugs were ordered anyway. Insurance claims stacked up, heavy and frequent, paid without seeing the bodies attached to them. By the time investigators stepped in, the damage was already done. Healthy cells had been burned, trust had been poisoned, and the man at the center of it all was not a shadowy criminal. He was a respected oncologist named Fareed Fada. Chapter 1, The Clinic That Never Slept. The clinic opened early, lights came on before sunrise, chairs were wiped down, IV poles were rolled into place. By 7:30 a.m., patients were already lining the hallway, some leaning on spouses, others alone and silent. They had been told the same thing. The cancer was aggressive. Waiting was not an option. Treatment had to start now. The doctor moved fast. He wore pressed coats and spoke with confidence. He did not hesitate when he read charts. He did not pause when he ordered chemotherapy. His tone carried certainty, the kind that shut down questions before they could form. Patients trusted him. They sat in recliners with blankets pulled to their chests. Nurses inserted needles. Clear fluid began to drip. Bags emptied. New ones replaced them. Chemotherapy was not subtle. Bodies reacted quickly. Nausea followed. Fatigue set in. Hair thinned. Skin changed. Some patients expected this. They believed suffering meant the drugs were working. Others were confused. They had come in walking. They had no pain. Their blood work had been close to normal before the diagnosis. Now they were being told they were seriously ill, that without treatment, they could die. Inside the infusion room, machines beeped in steady rhythms. The room smelled faintly of antiseptic and plastic tubing. Nurses moved from chair to chair, checking lines, logging times, keeping the schedule moving. The schedule was always full. It stood out. Other oncology practices had peaks and slow days. This one ran heavy, nonstop. Chemo chairs rarely sat empty. Patients were booked back to back, week after week. Some nurses noticed patterns that felt wrong. Lab results did not match the treatment plans. Blood counts that suggested mild conditions were paired with aggressive chemotherapy regimens. Scans described as alarming were not included in the files. When nurses asked for clarification, they were brushed off. The doctor had an answer for everything. He said the disease was deceptive. He said outside labs missed things. He said he saw patterns others did not. He discouraged delays. He discouraged second opinions. He framed urgency as care. Patients listened. A man in his 50s was told he had multiple myeloma. He did not feel sick. He still worked full days. He trusted the diagnosis because the doctor spoke without doubt. Chemotherapy began immediately. His strength faded within weeks. A woman in her 40s was told her cancer was spreading fast. She asked if more tests were needed. She was told time was the enemy. She agreed to treatment that same day. Family members watched loved ones deteriorate and blamed the disease. They did not question the drugs. They had been told this was the price of survival. Inside the clinic, nurses compared notes quietly. They noticed patients returning again and again, far longer than expected. Treatment plans were extended without clear milestones. Some patients never seemed to reach remission, yet their therapy never changed. Charts raised concerns. Diagnoses appeared exaggerated. Words like aggressive and terminal were used frequently, even when objective findings were thin. When staff raised questions, they were reminded who was in charge. The doctor had built the practice. He controlled decisions. He signed off on treatments. He spoke to patients alone, often without staff present. His authority was absolute. There was also money. Chemotherapy drugs were expensive. Insurance reimbursements were high. The volume of treatment meant the clinic billed constantly. Infusions ran long. Regimens were complex. Costs accumulated fast. Nurses were not privy to billing details, but they saw the volume. They saw the scale. They saw how many patients were receiving heavy drugs every day. Some felt uneasy. Others felt trapped. Speaking up meant risking jobs. Patients depended on the clinic. Walking away felt like abandonment, so concerns stayed mostly internal. Conversations happened in break rooms and hallways. Doubts were shared quietly without names attached. Patients continued to arrive. They signed consent forms they barely read. They trusted the system. They trusted the man in charge. The doctor cultivated that trust carefully. He spoke warmly. He framed himself as a fighter. He told patients he was aggressive because cancer demanded aggression. He rarely showed uncertainty. He rarely referred out. When patients asked why their friends with similar diagnoses were not receiving the same intensity of treatment, he said every case was unique. He said outside doctors were conservative. He said he was saving lives. The pressure to comply was constant. Chemotherapy days blurred together. Some patients lost track of time. They measured life in cycles and side effects. One patient questioned whether she was truly sick. Her symptoms never aligned with the diagnosis. When she raised doubts, she was told denial was common. She was told fear could make people resist treatment. Another patient asked for records to get a second opinion. The request was delayed. Paperwork took time. Treatment continued. The clinic functioned like a machine. Orders went out. Drugs came in. Infusions ran. Bills followed. From the outside, it looked like a thriving medical practice. From the inside, something felt off. A few nurses began documenting inconsistencies on their own. They kept mental notes, they remembered names, they noticed who declined rapidly after starting treatment, even when they had arrived relatively healthy. They also noticed fear. Patients trusted the doctor, but they were afraid of what he told them. Fear kept them compliant. Fear kept them in chairs, even when doubts crept in. Cancer was a word that shut down resistance. The doctor understood that power. He controlled the narrative, he controlled the pace, he controlled the information. In private, some staff began to suspect the unthinkable, that the treatments were not just excessive, that they might be unnecessary. That possibility was hard to accept. It clashed with everything they believed about medicine. Doctors healed, chemotherapy saved lives, clinics existed to help. The alternative meant harm, intentional harm. No one wanted to believe it. So the clinic kept moving, patients kept coming, drugs kept flowing. Outside the building, families waited in cars. Inside, IV lines delivered chemicals that damaged cells indiscriminately, cancerous or not. Healthy tissue suffered, immune systems weakened, pain followed, trust held everything together. By the end of the day, chairs emptied, bags were discarded, charts were filed. The doctor left, confident, respected, unquestioned. The nurses stayed behind to clean up. Some sat quietly for a moment before going home. They carried unease with them. They did not yet know how many patients would be affected. They did not yet know how far this went. But the pressure was building, and inside a clinic meant to heal, something dangerous had already taken root. Chapter 2, Patterns That Could Not Be Ignored. The first formal complaint did not come from a patient. It came from inside the system. A staff member stepped outside the clinic's walls and spoke to people who were not bound by hierarchy. The concern was simple and dangerous. Too many patients, too much chemotherapy, diagnoses that did not add up. At first, it sounded like a disagreement over medical judgment. That happened all the time. Oncology was complex. Doctors often differed on approach, but this was different. Records showed patients receiving aggressive chemotherapy without confirmed cancer staging. Some diagnoses were unsupported by pathology. Others were based on tests that did not exist in the file. When outside reviewers began pulling charts, they saw repetition. The same phrases appeared again and again: aggressive disease, rapid progression, immediate treatment required. They also saw volume. Insurance data revealed a clinic billing at levels far above comparable practices. Expensive chemotherapy drugs were ordered at a rate that stood out even among high-volume cancer centers. Treatments were frequent, prolonged, and rarely tapered. The numbers were hard to explain away. Insurers flagged the claims, audits followed, payment reviews expanded backward, then outward. Investigators began requesting full records, not summaries, not billing codes, everything. What came back raised alarms. Patients diagnosed with late-stage cancers had no corresponding imaging. Bone marrow biopsies did not support the conditions listed. Lab values contradicted the severity described in notes. In some cases, the documentation appeared altered, dates shifted, language exaggerated, critical qualifiers were missing. This was no longer about differing opinions, it was about accuracy. Federal authorities were notified. Healthcare fraud units began coordinating. Subpoenas were issued quietly. The investigation widened. Former employees were interviewed. Some were cautious, others were relieved to finally speak. They described pressure, orders that could not be questioned, a culture where speed mattered more than verification. They described fear. Patients were too scared to challenge diagnoses. Staff were too afraid to push back against authority. The system rewarded silence. Investigators focused on intent. Mistakes happened in medicine. Fraud required knowledge and purpose. They compared diagnoses to independent medical reviews. Case after case failed to meet criteria for the treatment given. They tracked billing trails, chemotherapy drugs ordered in bulk, infusions billed at maximum rates, reimbursements flowing steadily. The financial picture was stark. The practice generated millions through chemotherapy alone. The volume of drugs administered far exceeded norms. The longer patients stayed on treatment, the higher the revenue. Patterns emerged that could not be explained by patient mix or medical necessity. Investigators began contacting patients directly. Some were shocked. They had believed they were fighting for their lives. They had endured months or years of chemotherapy under that belief. Others were confused. They had suspected something was wrong but lacked the knowledge to prove it. Medical experts reviewed their cases independently. In many instances, those experts concluded the chemotherapy had not been needed. The emotional impact was immediate and severe. Patients had trusted their doctor with their lives. Now they were being told the suffering may have been unnecessary. Meanwhile, surveillance intensified. Billing continued even as scrutiny grew. Treatments did not slow. Patients kept receiving infusions. Investigators watched closely. They documented. They waited. When the evidence reached a critical mass, federal agents moved in. Search warrants were executed, records were seized, computers were imaged, drug inventories were examined. The scope of the case expanded rapidly. What had started as a whistleblower concern became one of the largest healthcare fraud investigations in the region. The doctor at the center of it all maintained innocence publicly. He continued to see patients, he continued to order treatment. Privately, the pressure mounted. Legal teams reviewed evidence. Prosecutors built timelines. They separated allegations from what could be proven beyond doubt. They focused on clear cases, patients with no cancer, patients misdiagnosed, patients harmed. The charges took shape slowly and deliberately. Healthcare fraud, false diagnoses, unnecessary chemotherapy. Each count represented a person, a body, a life altered. The investigation reached the point of no return. Arrest plans were made, indictments prepared. When federal charges were filed, the news moved fast. The respected oncologist was named. The allegations were detailed. The scale was staggering. In court filings, prosecutors laid out a pattern of deception. They described a system designed to maximize chemotherapy administration regardless of need. The language was careful. Allegations were clearly marked. Evidence was cited. The response was immediate. Patients flooded hotlines. Families demanded answers. The medical community reeled. The clinic shut down. Treatment stopped abruptly. Some patients were left in limbo, unsure of their true diagnoses, unsure what damage had been done. Medical teams scrambled to reassess cases. Second opinions were rushed. Reality set in unevenly. Meanwhile, the criminal case moved forward. Prosecutors offered evidence that left little room for ambiguity. They presented expert reviews, billing analyses, and patient records side by side. The intent became clearer with each comparison. This was not one error repeated, it was a system repeated with purpose. Faced with the evidence, the doctor's defense shifted. The courtroom became the next focal point. Victims filled benches, reporters filled rows. The man who had once spoken with certainty now listened. When the plea came, it was decisive. Fareed Fada pleaded guilty to multiple federal charges. He admitted to giving chemotherapy to patients who did not need it. He admitted to lying about diagnoses to bill insurers. The admission carried weight. For patients, it confirmed the worst fear, that the suffering had been real and that it had not been necessary. For prosecutors, it closed the question of intent. The case moved toward sentencing, but the damage could not be undone. Chemotherapy scars remained, physical weakness lingered, emotional trust was shattered. The investigation had exposed a failure not just of one doctor, but of systems meant to protect patients. And as the courtroom doors closed on the plea, a final question hung in the air. How had this gone on for so long without stopping? That question would define what came next. Chapter 3, The Cost That Could Not Be Repaid. The courtroom was quiet when sentencing began, not empty, quiet. People filled the benches, but no one spoke. They waited for the numbers that would follow a confession that had already rewritten their lives. The judge reviewed the record slowly. Dates, counts, confirmed facts, the language stayed precise. This was not a story, it was an accounting. The charges described years of deception, false diagnoses, chemotherapy given without medical need, insurance claims built on lies. The evidence had been tested. The plea had closed the argument. The court turned to the defendant. Fareed Fata stood and listened. The man who once dominated exam rooms now spoke only when asked. His words were measured. He acknowledged the crimes. He accepted responsibility. Victims were invited to speak. One by one, patients and family members approached the microphone. Some read from notes. Others spoke from memory, voices shaking, stopping, starting again. A woman described losing her hair and her strength while believing she was fighting cancer. She spoke about months of sickness that stole time she could never get back. She said the hardest part was learning she had not been sick to begin with. A man described watching his wife deteriorate under chemotherapy that was never needed. He spoke about hospital visits that replaced vacations, about fear that settled into their home and never left. Another patient spoke about trust, about how doctors were supposed to be the last place lies lived. He said the damage was not only physical. It changed how he saw every white coat afterward. The judge listened. The prosecution summarized the harm in concrete terms. Chemotherapy damaged healthy tissue. Immune systems were weakened. Long-term complications followed. Anxiety and depression took hold. The impact was widespread and lasting. The defense asked for mercy. They pointed to the guilty plea. They pointed to cooperation. They asked the court to consider the totality of the circumstances. The sentence came down heavy and final. Decades in federal prison, restitution ordered, assets seized. The room exhaled. There was no celebration, no sense of closure. The numbers did not heal bodies. They did not restore trust. They marked an end, not a repair. Outside the courtroom, cameras waited, headlines followed. The case was described as one of the most severe examples of healthcare fraud in the country. But inside hospital rooms across Michigan, the aftermath played out quietly. Patients returned to doctors they no longer trusted. Medical records were reviewed line by line. Second opinions became the rule, not the exception. Some learned they had never had cancer. Others learned their conditions were minor, manageable, never life-threatening. The relief was complicated. Relief came with anger, with grief for lost time, with questions that had no answers. Why had no one stopped it sooner? Why warnings were missed? Why the system had paid without looking closer? Regulators responded. Medical boards reviewed oversight failures. Insurers changed auditing practices. Flags were adjusted, thresholds lowered. Reviews expanded. Hospitals issued statements. Clinics updated protocols. Training emphasized verification and peer review. These were necessary steps. They were also late. For the patients who had already suffered, reform felt abstract. Some continued to deal with side effects years later. Nerve damage, chronic fatigue, heart problems linked to toxic exposure. Others dealt with something harder to measure, fear. They hesitated before every appointment. They questioned every recommendation. They read reports themselves. They counted pills. They watched faces for signs of dishonesty. The relationship between doctor and patient had been altered. The medical community struggled with the stain. Most oncologists practiced with integrity. They followed evidence. They saved lives. Yet the case cast a shadow. Patients arrived guarded. Trust had to be rebuilt slowly. Conferences addressed the scandal. Papers were written. Panels debated safeguards. The language was careful. Lessons learned. Systems strengthened. Still, one fact remained. This had not been a hidden crime. It had happened in plain sight. Chemotherapy chairs filled daily, billing flowed regularly, diagnoses were accepted without challenge. The system trusted credentials, it trusted volume, it trusted the assumption that harm was unlikely inside a clinic. That trust had been exploited. Years later, when appeals were exhausted and headlines faded, the case remained a reference point. A warning cited in training sessions, an example used to justify audits. It became shorthand for what happens when authority goes unchecked. For the victims, the story never ended neatly. Some found peace and accountability, others never did. They measured justice, not in years sentenced, but in the knowledge that someone else might be spared. They shared their stories with investigators, with journalists, with new patients who asked why they were cautious. Their voices became part of the safeguard. Inside prison walls, the man who once controlled a medical empire adjusted to confinement. His status was gone. His license revoked, his influence ended. The law had spoken clearly. But the final cost could not be tallied. It lived in bodies altered by drugs never needed, in families changed by fear, in a profession forced to confront its blind spots. The clinic no longer existed, the chairs were empty, the IV poles gone. What remained was a question the system could not ignore. How many safeguards were enough when trust itself could be weaponized? There was no easy answer, only vigilance, only scrutiny, only the understanding that healing demanded more than expertise. It demanded accountability. And for those who had trusted and been harmed, that truth came too late, but it stood as the last line written in a case that redefined betrayal inside medicine.